All right. Last week, we were talking about redaction and consolidation. And that created kind of a lively discussion and a lot of things going on. So what I wanted to do tonight was to kind of put a little bit more meat on those bones and give you some examples, because sometimes it's kind of hard to just conceptualize what we're talking about. Who remembers what redaction is, by the way? Anyone? Additions. Additions, very good. Additions and changes to the text. It can be additions, it can be subtractions, but it's changes to the text. The analogy that was used was modifications to a car. You know, the car, as it comes off the assembly line, a manufactured assembly line, that's composition. The addition of additional headers and souped up this and that, those are the redactions or the changes. And so we talked about the compositional process, how it's layered, how it happened in stages, how it happened over a period of time. And the redaction process comes on the heels of that. And then there was, once copies were being made across a geographical area, then we went into the process of consolidation. And what was consolidation? How was that defined? Anyone remember that one? A little bit squishier definition.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's modifications to the text, primarily based upon the worldview of the scribe that's copying.
Okay. So basically, in certain geographic areas, this is the text accommodating itself to the community, and the community accommodating itself to the text. So it's kind of that sitting in process. You know, you get a new chair and you got to make it kind of fit. And over time, it starts to conform to you. The result of that are these textual changes. Not massive textual changes. They're shades of meaning. And we went through some of those. And we'll look at some of how that happens also. A lot of it is intentional, based on theological ideas and the way that the community looks at the world. And some of it is more subtle than that. It has to do with, because of the way you look at life, you will interpret things a certain way. You will copy them or translate them a certain way. If there is a way that you can go down one side or another, which way are you going to choose? Remember, we told you about the difficulties in translating, the difficulties. Sometimes they're judgment calls, and the text is not clear at all. How do you interpret that? It's going to be through your lens, through the way that you look at life. And one community is going to do it in a different way than another community is that's removed in geographical space. And so those variations are the consolidations, and we can see the evidence. We can see the pockmarks, like on the far side of the moon, of how that occurred as we look at these different textual families. What we're driving toward tonight, and we'll see how far we get, is toward talking, really having a good understanding of what a textual family is. That's what we need to understand tonight. But I want to go through some of this so that you can get a clear idea of how these textual families actually came into being. The other thing that I haven't been too good at doing is locking down what we do to the textbook. And if you notice, those of you who have the textbook and are trying to follow along, part one were preliminary matters regarding the Bible. That was the whole first couple of months. We talked about what the Bible was, what it wasn't, and we talked about, in general terms, trying to place that. Some of the material in this first section we're still going to go through later on, because I'm doing this stuff a little bit out of order. And we're going to talk about the actual Bible, how it's set up, and the various pieces and parts to it. And that would have been in that first section. Part two, the canonization of the Bible, obviously we went through that and talking about what the canon means, what the process was, and all of that. Now we're into part three, which is the transmission of the Bible. And this is where the Bible, now canonized, is being transmitted through time to the various communities that are going to be reading it. And that's where we're in now. The sections that I've given you are all from our textbook, and they're going to deal with this area of transmission of the Bible. And what I want to do to start off with is we're going to start with the Old Testament. We'll move to the New Testament. I want to read some sections here because they can't be put any better than this, and we can discuss them a little bit and hopefully understand what it is that the author is talking about here. So any questions about redactions, consolidations left over from last week, or things that weren't clear before we dive in? Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Consolidation, I can see if you're doing a translation and and you say, well, it's a gender neutral thing, I can pick whatever I think's right, and you write the one you think's right, but some of them seem like they're just flat cheated, you know, just like, well, I think it ought to be like this, and they just sort of change the thing.
And
in
some cases, that's exactly what happened. Hopefully, what this when we go through this process tonight, what you're going to find out is happening. Remember, we talked about when an author was writing the autograph. Did the author know that what he was writing was canonical scripture that was going to be lasting throughout the ages, through millennia? And the answer we said was probably not. Most likely, the author didn't have any idea. The author was writing clearly for the audience right in front of him or her that was going to be receiving the text in that time frame. What you find out is in the first generations and the first even few hundred years or centuries after the writing of a text, things are still pretty fluid. There isn't that sense yet that it's set in stone. There isn't that sense yet that this is canonical scripture. You know, you see that especially with the letters of Paul and the other apostles. You know, there's still a fluidity about this. And then there are stages that it kind of goes through, where then there's more of a sense of reverence to it. And then as it's canonized, of course, now there's a sense that you don't mess with this. This is God's word. But in the earlier stages, it's still kind of wild and woolly, and there's some movement there. With these earlier communities, these Christian communities that you're referring to, that was in the stages when things were still a little bit fluid. Remember, there was 300 years from the crucifixion to the time that there was a sense of a final canon. And in that period, things were moving. And there wasn't the sense that you were doing wrong or that you were cheating if you changed a few words here and there, because this is how they were coming to understand who Jesus was, who God was, how all this fit together. And so their theology and their understanding of this was very much a part of the process. And so I guess I want to just let you know that we look at it the way we look at it from a vantage point of 2,000 years hence. If it was 50 years hence, we would have a very different point of view about how we're viewing these scriptures. And remember, they're living documents. You know, the Bible is living and active. We don't mess with the text anymore. But these things are living documents as they're moving forward, especially through the period where it's oral tradition. When we don't even know what changes might have been made during the oral tradition part, because the first Gospels weren't written until at least 50 years after the crucifixion. The first letters of Paul weren't written until 15 or maybe 20 years after the crucifixion. So we're talking about there is some time span. And even though that sounds really short in the span of two millennia, think about something that occurred in the 60s and we're just starting to write it down now. What kind of movement can happen in the stories, you know? We're talking right now about the death of Ted Kennedy. You know how we remembered Ted Kennedy in the 60s or 70s and what was going on, and how we remember him now are two very different things. And so the history or the way that he's being presented now is from the vantage point of him as a 77-year-old. When he was in his 30s, you know, there's a different perspective. And so what I'm saying is that attitudes change and things change as time goes forward. And 50 years, that can be an eternity. I mean, that's a couple of generations, right? So anyway, that's a long way of just going about saying it's easy for us to put a pejorative sort of idea that this was wrong, this was cheating, but they wouldn't have looked at it that way at the time. Yeah?
Question. How many of the New Testament Gospels and letters were not written by the apostle?
The apostles?
Mark, Luke, John, James. How many of them were written by someone else, or whether it could have been that oral traditions merger?
Are you talking about the four canonical gospels, or are you talking about extra canonical gospels? Are you talking about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John? Were they written by Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John? That's what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay, well, traditionally, they are given the authorship of the book that bears their name. Scholars of all different stripes admit the possibility, and some of them will say the likelihood, that none of them were written by the evangelist whose name the book is attached to. That they would have been written or compiled by others. But we don't know for sure. How can we ever know? You know?
So they could have passed away and somebody else wrote it and said, I got their notes and...
Yeah, and remember again that the attitude in first century in the first century Mediterranean area, again, very different. No copyright laws, no notion of copywriting or plagiarism. The person writing, who maybe was a disciple of Luke or Matthew or John, would have written in their name as a sign of respect to them, or because they're carrying on the torch or the school of thought of that person. So, the bottom line is we don't know for sure. So, in the absence of not knowing, why not say it was Matthew, Mark, and Luke and John, unless there's evidence to the contrary? The most important thing from our point of view, I think, is to realize that they were compiled and not composed. That's a big difference, and that's something that we can know pretty much for sure. At least the evidence points to that. That Luke tells us he compiled this from a lot of different sources, and he was picking and pulling. And so when we see discrepancies between Luke and Matthew, for instance, where Matthew takes all the material in the Sermon on the Mount and puts it beautifully into three chapters, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and you see that same material blown out over the entire Lukean Gospel, is there a right or a wrong? Did someone mess up? No, there was a purpose behind what they were writing. Matthew had a purpose in organizing the material the way he did and putting it all in one place. Now, is that wrong because, well, then historically it's not accurate? Well, that wasn't their intent, to be historically accurate. Whether Jesus said all these things in one place in one time, or whether he said them across the 3 years of his ministry, is not so important. Could he have done both? Absolutely. Maybe he had one sermon where he did it all, and then he also had, we just don't know for sure. But I think what we're trying to say is let's kind of lighten up about some of these issues that don't have any real ramifications in terms of our faith or in terms of the spiritual intent of what the gospel is trying to get across. So obviously these are things that I think are important. Whether Luke actually penned Luke or somebody else did in his name, or whether somebody else did and tradition ascribed it to Luke, those are unknowable things, And everybody comes down on different places on that. So, yeah.
You answered my question really, really well, but I didn't say it right. So, yes, that was my question. But I'm glad you said that.
Okay.
It helped me clear my question. I was thinking post-canonical times, but I didn't clarify that. So are we to consider that there wasn't a lot of consolidation post-canonical time?
There's still some consolidation going on post-canonically, but it lessens. What we see more than consolidation is we see copy errors happening as time goes forward. Yeah. But there are some what are known as emendations, and emendations are a step further than redactions. They are critical changes to a text. They're doing it for a specific purpose. And I'm going to give, there are some examples in here, so maybe we should dive into this and see how far that takes us, but feel free to keep asking questions, okay? Because this is right where we're at, And I know it's hard for us to sometimes legitimize changes to this text, but here's what the evidence is telling us. Let's read this column together, this Old Testament textual criticism, page 177 if you're in your book, and it's the first sheet if you're in sheets. The 20th century has witnessed a great increase in the number of Hebrew sources available to the textual critic. Talking about Old Testament now, okay? In fact, many of the sources have been found within the last 60 years. Example is the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masada manuscripts and the silver amulets. This means that the Old Testament textual critic is better equipped to answer difficult questions regarding the original text than ever before. Remember, the original text is that text which is reconstructed but would be the same as the autograph. All right? And we talked about all of the archaeological finds, especially of the last 100 to 150 years. But as he says, in the last 60 years, since the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi find, just an explosion in the amount of text that we have available to us and fragments. In general, these manuscripts have revealed that there were three main stages in the development of the Old Testament biblical text. One, a rather fluid original text to which the scribes added explanations or elaborations at will. Okay, that's what I was telling you about that first stage where it's so kind of wild and woolly. 2, a more fixed text to which minor additions and corrections were added for better understanding of the text. Example, Matres Lectionis, Mother of Reading, that's Latin for Mothers of Reading, were Hebrew consonants added to the text before the origination of the vowel pointing to aid in pronunciation and understanding. See the discussion earlier in this chapter. We'll talk about that later. 3, a relatively stabilized text from which any variations were removed. Okay, so that's what I was describing to you. At first it's kind of fluid, and then it starts to solidify, and then it really stabilizes, especially when it's realized that this is canonical, and that sort of mindset sets in.
Dave?
Yeah.
When it says relatively stabilized text from which any variations were removed being past tense, meaning that somewhat fluid state that it began in, something went back, analyzed,
yes, exactly that.
More,
yeah, we're talking about the Old Testament here, which has a different history than the New Testament. But in the Old Testament, the Masoretes, which were a group of scribes, especially working from the 6th through the 8th centuries, they went back and they were really solidifying the text. They were looking at all the variations and they came up with a single text. And we got a couple of graphics to kind of show the way different scholars now envision that process to have occurred, but that's exactly what they're saying. They actually went through and harmonized the variations that they found into a single text that was called the Masoretic Text and is now equivalent to the modern Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh. Okay? Let's see, where was I? Okay, even though we do not have any original autographs of the biblical authors, this does not mean that there is no way to determine the accuracy of the biblical text. The many biblical sources that have been discovered can be compared and evaluated to determine the most accurate reading of a text. This is the main goal of Old Testament textual criticism, which can be defined as the science and art that seeks to determine the most reliable wording of the biblical text. Okay, seems pretty straightforward, right? It's a science because specific rules govern the evaluation of various types of copyist errors and readings. But it's also an art because these rules cannot be rigidly applied in every situation. Intuition and common sense must guide the critic in the process of determining the most plausible reading. And that is the key. What's the most plausible reading of the text? Informed judgments about a text depend upon one's familiarity with the types of copyist errors, manuscripts, versions, and their authors. The importance of Old Testament textual criticism is threefold. First and foremost, it attempts to establish the most reliable reading of the text. Second, in cases where a definitive reading is impossible to determine, it can help to avoid dogmatism. Okay, what does that mean, dogmatism? It means a belief that's not based on anything. You know, it's just arbitrarily decided that this is going to be the belief. In other words, we're going to base church authority on a certain reading. If we know that if the textual critics, the scholars are telling us, we can't be for sure, certain, what the reading of this passage is, it avoids plopping down the authority of the church on that particular passage. You don't want to do that if you're not really sure what the reading or the meaning is. And so textual criticism can help avoid those kind of situations. Does that make sense?
Like not eating meat on Friday.
Like not eating meat on Friday, she said. So they don't have to go back and change it in the next council. And third, it can help the reader better understand the significance of marginal readings that appear in various Bible translations. Thus, the study of Old Testament textual criticism leads to increased confidence in the reliability of the text. Okay? So you see what's happening. We're comparing all these different manuscripts, and we're looking at them, and through that forensic evidence, coming to an idea of what the most plausible readings are. If you've got these various textual families, and they're all saying something slightly different in a certain passage, which one's the most plausible? All right? That's what we're trying to get at. And so I'll go to the next page. What principles do you use in order to determine the most plausible reading? At the bottom of the first column, basic principles for Old Testament textual criticism, page 179 if you're in the book. The principles that must be used to determine which reading is more original, okay, always that holy grail of the original text, are as follows. Number one, manuscripts must be weighed and not counted. All right, what does that mean? They don't mean physically weigh them. Exactly. What it means is that if one of the ways to decide what a most plausible reading is, remember we said we have 24,000 either full manuscripts or fragments, right? One of the ways to do that is to go through all the fragments and manuscripts that you have of a specific target text and count how many manuscripts have one reading and another reading and another reading. And so you get sort of a hierarchy. So you can just make a plausible reading by saying, okay, 70% of the texts available have this reading, reading A, and then, you know, 15% have reading B and the balance have reading C. But rather than just counting them, you have to weigh the importance of the manuscripts that you are actually using or you have available to you at the time. Because not all manuscripts are created equal in the eyes of textual critics. So they're going to weigh the importance, and they're going to go by you know, the age of the manuscript, the reliability, the language in which it is written, and so on and so forth. So you weigh the manuscripts. You don't simply count them as you're trying to come to what you think would be the most plausible reading. Does that make sense? Okay, weighing instead of counting. Two, determine which reading would most likely give rise to the others. Okay, so if you've got variant readings, it looks like reading A would have been the mother reading, and then down here you have two other readings that have similar traits that point it back to meaning A. And so you kind of look in a timeline and you create that sort of family tree. And if you can tell if there are similar traits, for example, in Matthew and Luke, there is X amount of material that is common to Mark. All right. So scholars believe that Mark came first, and Matthew and Luke had Mark as a source text, one of the source texts to be able to use as they were compiling their Gospels. And that's how they kind of look at it. If they see two source texts that have similar material to another one, but that one doesn't have material common to the other ones, then you can say which one's the chicken and which one's the egg. And that's basically what they're talking about. Number three, the more distinctive reading is usually preferable. Okay? In other words, they're saying if it's left in a highly difficult state, in other words, it's not harmonized, it's not tried to smooth out the text, it's distinctive, it maybe it creates some cognitive dissonance, it's a hard reading, it's probably the most basic way to say it. That one is probably older than one that has been smoothed out and the edges ground down and made more palatable, because that usually happens over time. Okay, remember, these are guidelines. They're not hard and fast rules. Four, the shorter reading is generally favored. Why? Huh? People add, you know, as things move through time, generally they get added to rather than subtracted from. That's not always true, but generally that's the case. So shorter reading is preferred. And five, determine which reading is most appropriate to the context. Examine literary structure, grammatical or spelling errors in historical context. That one's pretty straightforward. Reading on. The first principle is important in that age, accuracy, and a manuscript's relation to other manuscripts help determine its importance. Kyle MacArthur of Johns Hopkins believes that principle two is the primary basis for textual criticism and that all other principles derive from it. That is that family tree we talked about. The third principle is built on the premise that when a scribe adds something to a text, he will more likely add something he is familiar with or it makes sense to him. Okay? Thus, a reading that at first glance seems hard to understand, but after careful thought makes good sense, is very possibly an original reading. The fourth principle suggests that a scribe is more likely to add to divine scripture, example, a clarifying note or explanation, than to remove something. And the next step is to determine which reading is most likely the correct one.
Three and four would be consolidation.
What's that?
Based on what you just described, three and four would be consolidation.
They could be. They could be, yeah. Right, right. There's a great quote that we're coming to later where, what does he say? He says something like, a copyist who thinks is much more dangerous than one who doesn't and just is just copying, you know, because the one who's thinking about the text and trying to smooth out these edges is the one who's going to make more changes. And the changes that someone makes for a specific purpose are a lot harder to find than ones that are simple copying errors. And we're going to look at some of the copying errors on the next page. So determining the most plausible reading down here at the bottom is a combination of looking at external evidence and internal evidence. You know, the external evidence is all the other non-canonical books and sources that we have to look at. And we're going to look at some of those just in a chart. The internal evidence is what the text can actually tell us. All right. So using these rules that we just went through, it's going to be real important when we get to this King James only and later versions, you know, in the New Testament, because these are the same rules that will be used for the New Testament as for the Old in trying to determine the most plausible reading, which is designed to get us closer and closer to the original text. All right? So weighing both what we can find from external sources and the internal evidence is what these rules are being applied to, outside sources and the text itself. Let's see. Oh, so the external evidence. Go ahead and turn the page. So when you're looking at the external evidence, what are you looking at? There's five little rules there. The language of the witness. A witness is a manuscript or a fragment. That's what they call a witness. Okay? So when you see that, that's what they're referring to. The language of the witness, the date of the witness, the reliability of the witness, the provenance, which is the origin of the source and the purpose of the witness, and the interdependence of the witnesses. So they're looking at all of those when they're looking at this internal evidence. All right? Here's a list of this table 11.4 is great. Unintentional changes in the Hebrew text. These are your basic copy errors. And think about whenever you are asked to copy something, what are the kind of errors that you normally make? Good one. I like that. The type of errors that you would normally make, whether you're typing a copy or whether you're handwriting a copy, are going to be right here on this list. These are the most likely things that happen, and they happen all the time. You know, mistaken letters, confusion of similar letters. And these possible examples are kind of interesting because they'll give you examples of where these might have occurred. For instance, here, Genesis 10:4 cites a race known as the Dodanim, and 1 Chronicles 1:7 calls them the Rodanim. So you've just got a confusion of letters. Homophony, number two, is a substitution of similar sounding words. And Isaiah 9:2, this word, which means not, was apparently incorrectly substituted for a word to him or to it. So when you add that to the text, compare, thou hast multiplied the nation and not increased their joy, to the NIV, which reads, you have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. Big difference in the meaning there. And, you know, notice that it's the NIV, a 20th century version, that is creating the change, because that is taking into consideration a lot more witnesses in terms of making that determination of, and how would they find it? Well, they're going through that process. They're finding a lot more witnesses that have the second reading rather than the first, and then they're trying to make the most plausible decision about what that reading should be. Haplography, number three, is the omission of a letter or word, usually due to a similar letter or word in context. All right? Didography, a letter or word that has been written twice rather than once. In Jeremiah 51:3, the word yidrok, he drew, appears twice. And so we know they made a mistake. Metathesis, reversal in order of two letters or words. Okay, kind of a transliteration there. Not transliteration, what's the word? Transposition. Okay, number six, fusion, incorrect word division that results in two words joined as one. And I wanted to read you... This one is, if I can find it, where was it? It's fascinating the way this one worked out. Okay, fusion, incorrect word division. Remember that Hebrew is written in all consonants. Ancient Hebrew is. It was the Masoretes that started. When they talk about pointing, they're talking about they put little diacritical marks, little dots and dashes over the consonants to point to what the vowel sounds should be. So eventually, there was a system for pointing to the vowels, but the ancient text didn't carry those. There is a controversy over whether the consonants were always in a continuous stream or if there really were some sort of parsing of the words. Some, like this right here, if you are on page, if you go to page 166, there is an ancient carving here that was at the end of a tunnel. And they, even though it was written in an earlier script, they put dots between the words. And sometimes they tried to leave spaces between the words, but it was often really hard to tell. So what this is interesting is that unclear or absent word divisions provide great potential for misreading the consonantal text, as the following English example illustrates. And what they did was they wrote G-O-D-I-S-N-O-W-H-E-R-E, all together. And that can be read as either God is now here or God is nowhere, all depending on how you parse the word. And there is a passage in Amos 6:12. And the usual way that it's translated is, do horses run on the rocky crags? Second line, does one plow with oxen? But you have turned justice into poison and the fruit of righteousness into bitterness. Well, the problem is, rhetorically, is there something wrong here? Because the first one, do horses run on rocky crags? The obvious answer is no. But the second one, does one plow with oxen? Well, the answer is yes. But where it's leading then is, but you have turned justice into poison. So rhetorically, we want two no answers, two obvious no answers, so that the analog to the conclusion is clear. Well, what happens is that the word with oxen was in the plural, and yet it's usually a collective noun. And so what we would see as im, so Baba Karim would be the word. But the I am is unnecessary because oxen, like for us, is plural, is collective and doesn't need the ending. So if you parse it and take the I am ending off, which in Hebrew is Yod Mem, it spells the word Yam, which means sea or ocean. And so the second line then would read, would you plow the sea with oxen? And see how now it works rhetorically? Do horses run on a rocky crag? Craig, do you plow the sea with oxen? Yeah, yet you have turned justice into poison. So those parsings of the words are incredibly important to the meaning. And it's really easy to miss, you know, especially if you've got Western Europeans translating a Hebrew text, you know, later on, then there's all kinds of possibility for concern. So this one, fusion, that's a biggie. And then there's fission, incorrect word division that results in one word written as two. Now this next one, homoio teluton. These Greek words are murder, aren't they? Homoio teluton, an omission caused by two words or phrases that end similarly. This is not a rhyme, but a near rhyme. So if you see a similar ending of things, or the next one, homoio arcton, is a similar beginning of the word, your eye tends to see it. So if you're going line by line, and you see the same beginning of the next line, you think you've already copied that line and you skip to the next one, that's exactly what they're talking about. Or the same thing can happen at the end. And so we see omissions of lines. Look at number 8. In Samuel 14:41, a portion is missing from the Masoretic text that appears in other versions. The Septuagint reads, and Saul said, O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day if the iniquity is in me or in the son Jonathan, and blah, blah, blah. The words between the two italicized words do not appear in the Masoretic text, perhaps because the scribe jumped from the first occurrence of the word Israel to the third, omitting the words in between. And there's a couple more that I wanted to show you. If you're in your text, you can go to page 167. We did that one. Page 182 and 145. These are really interesting. But I want to give you these examples so you can see what actually is happening. Let me find this other one. Okay. In Genesis 4:8, it reads as follows in the Hebrew Bible, and Cain told Abel his brother, and it came about that when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Did you notice any problem there? What did Cain tell his brother? All right? And so in the Masoretic text, the Hebrew text, that's how it reads. And Cain told Abel his brother, and then it just goes on. And there is no quote of what he said. But if you look in the Septuagint, which was that Greek translation of the Hebrew from the 2nd or 3rd century, the Syriac Peshitta, the Latin Vulgate, the Samaritan Pentateuch, lots of those external witnesses we were talking about, if you compare all those, you find that there is another word that includes the phrase, let us go into the field. All right. So Abel told Cain, his brother, let us go into the field, and then the rest of the story ensues. So there was an omission. Was it an omission because of 1 or 8 and 9? We don't exactly know, but we can tell that there's logically an omission. Now, here's a case. Remember we said shorter is normally better? Shorter is normally the most plausible reading? Well, here's a case where logically, where it's more of an art than a science, you can't just blindly follow the rules. You got to see, okay, in this case, the longer is a more plausible reading because of the context internally looking at it. Right? Another one, Psalm 145 is an alphabetic acrostic. You know what acrostic is? It's where it takes the first letter of a word and then runs that down. Alphabetically, each line of Psalm 145 starts with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet, 22 letters. Right? But in the Masoretic text, there's no line starting with the letter N or Nun in Hebrew. And so we know that there had to have been an omission. But so if you look at the Dead Sea Scroll manuscripts, the Septuagint and again the Syriac Peshitta, they include the following line beginning with the letter Nun, which is the Lord is faithful in all his promises and merciful toward all his works. Okay? And he says right here, this line may have been omitted due to a homoioarcton, that is a similarity between the beginning of two words or lines causing one of them to be left out. In this case, the verse 13 would have begun with the phrase, the Lord is faithful, and verse 14 with, the Lord upholds all who are fallen. It is plausible that the copyist skipped verse 13 because the word Lord appeared in both phrases. Okay, again, the longer reading being the most plausible, but it's obvious because of the context what's going on. All right, and then the last one, just any other omissions. You know, for instance, the years that Saul reigned are omitted from 1 Samuel 13:1 in the Masoretic text. So we see that these logical... Think about the person who's going through and reading the Bible with this microscopic level. But this is who these people are. And they're not just doing it with a biblical text. They've got that same microscope on all of these witnesses, these thousands of witnesses, and then the external as well, comparing laboriously over and over again to try to find out what's the most plausible reading. That's why these 20th century versions have the benefit of all that scholarship and all that work.
So what was the time frame when they, the first time when they were all trying to figure this out?
Well, you mean textual criticism? Textual criticism really came into the fore in the 19th century. So the 1800s is when this was really starting to take place, and of course ever since as well. I mean, I'm not to say there wasn't any textual criticism, but this is when it really became a high art form. And when you look back, especially in medieval times, there was no questioning of the text. In fact, the text was being held by the Roman Church, and you couldn't even get your hands on a copy. It wasn't for you to read. And so that had to be broken down before the text was actually in the hands of the lay people, let alone being translated into the language, you know, the common language of the people. So that was kind of an evolution as well.
I think you answered my question. I was going to ask, what would be better for us to read if we were studying? Would it be one of the older texts like the Peshitta or one of the 20th century, now the NIV, or to get the most out of it?
And that's a huge matter of debate, too, because you got the King James only people who would say, no, you know, everything since King James has been corrupted. And now they're using texts that do not. Of course, they don't believe in those five rules we just read. And they couldn't if they're going to conform to the King James, an older text. But I believe, to answer your question, that it's good to have a combination. It's good to have a newer 20th century version, like an NIV or NASB. And then we're going to have to talk about the difference between NASB and NIV, because NIV is a dynamic translation, and NASB is a literal translation, so there's differences even there. But at least both of those have the advantage of this scholarship we're talking about and all of these witnesses we're talking about. But King James, there are some versions of you know, passages in King James that you just can't hear any other way, you know, because of the beauty of the language. The King James is a masterpiece of English literature. The rendition of the text and the reading, the cadence of it, It's absolutely, you know, the 23rd Psalm for me is nothing ever except "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." You put it into anything else and it just sounds flat to me. You know, for devotional reading and also for clarity sometimes, it's good to have both of them together. And then a good paraphrase can help tremendously. The Living Bible or the Message can also help. So what I like to do is have one of each one. You know, you can have a literal, modern, and a dynamic, which is a thought-for-thought translation that kind of smooths out some of the language. And then you can have the King James. You can also have your paraphrase. So all of these can help you to try to understand a text better. And whether you're trying to do it simply in terms of study or devotionally, you know, take your pick. But I think at least we need to be aware of the differences between them and have all of those bullets in our gun, you know. Is that okay? Bill, did you have something?
Me?
Yeah, you. Did you have your hand up?
No, I'm
okay.
Sure.
All right. Let's turn the page. Hey, we're kind of moving through these kind of fast, huh? Not bad. We're doing better. Yeah, go ahead, Bill. Bill's going to slow us down right now, though.
Has anybody come up with like a website that's got the latest guest? So we don't have to wait for them to issue another book.
The latest guess on what?
Well, like this passage right here, we just got some older manuscripts, and it really should say this.
Oh, no. No, I don't know of any like that. I haven't really scoured that much. You might be able to find one.
Well,
you know?
There's copyright problems.
But, you know, and of course, all this stuff is so ultra-controversial. The last group to really work on this heavily was the Jesus Seminar, and you might have heard of some of those. And if you heard about them through evangelical circles, they were throwing tomatoes at the same time they were mentioning it. But what these scholars did, based out of the University of Claremont over here, was they went through the gospel, the words of Jesus, with exactly this process. And what they did was they color-coded each saying of Jesus to the level of plausibility that he actually said those words. And so what they came up with was a color-coded New Testament. And they actually printed each passage with the consensus of this group as to what color, and I don't know what the colors were, from most likely or least likely that they are authentic and were actually said by Jesus. And so rather than just a red letter version, you have this multicolored version that gave you the sense of these scholars using this sort of process as to what the likelihood was. And there wasn't a whole lot left that they were sure that Jesus said by the time they came to the end of that process. But they were involved in that sort of work.
Have they printed a Bible?
Yeah, there is a Jesus Seminar Bible that you can buy if you're inclined to see what their idea was. That was in the last 15, 20 years. It's fairly recent. And I think it was late 80s, early 90s. I'm not sure,
early
but
90s.
Yeah. Early 90s? Yeah. When this, and of course it was anathema to conservative Christians, and they were fighting it tooth and nail. But this is their idea. Yeah, Jen.
Was it like three guys in a room, or was it like a huge group of people?
I don't think it wasn't. It was more than three. But you know, bigger than a bread box. And, I don't know how many scholars. I think I seem to remember somewhere between 15, 25, 30, somewhere in that range. You know, and so it wasn't a huge group, but it was a very acclaimed group of scholars. But they tend to be more on the liberal side to even entertain to do such a thing. So already they had a certain bent, you know, within their thinking. But they're using these principles to try to ascertain what was, you know, most likely, most plausible. He's on his own back there, so he's probably going to pop out every once in a while. Oh, good, good. Any other questions about that? Okay, yeah, there, I don't know of any where you can go to find the latest scholarship, but most of this stuff, and let me just reinforce one more time. These changes are shades of meaning. They're not going to reveal something so shocking that the church crumbles. You know, like when the Gospel of Thomas was coming into popular notoriety, and the idea was, you know, that this was going to reveal this thing that was going to destroy the church, and it's like it's not those kinds of things. They're shades of meaning. But they're important to those who are trying to find the original text, you know, that Holy Grail again. So these are tools that they use. Now, if you turn the page to 181, or just go to the next sheet, that next table, 11.5, those were, the first one we looked at, 11.4, were unintentional changes, just copyist errors. These are intentional changes. You know, these are a whole different level. Like we said, they're harder to find because they don't have those usual copyist errors. When you see two words in a row, you figure, okay, didography, right? And if you see letters being transposed or something, you know what's going on, and you can they're easier to spot because we know what they are. Intentional changes aren't going to have those telltale signs. And so now you've really got to look between the witnesses to find where they may have occurred. So number one, changes of rare or unusual usages of word. Okay, if there was a rare or unusual usage of a word, a later copyist may substitute this word that means the same thing, but it's a more normal usage. And the example here, Isaiah 39:1 on the Masoretic text, uses the word hazat with the unusual meaning of to get well or to recuperate. But changes of it, later changes of it use haya, which has the same meaning. Okay, same meaning, but a more normal word for that context. Two, euphemistic changes. Okay, words that are now substituting for another word. Shame replaces the Hebrew word for Baal in 2 Samuel 2:8 into Ishbosheth with 1 Chronicles 8:33. So just changing the word again, not changing the meaning, but changing the word euphemistically. Number three, additions and or glosses. In Genesis 7:6, the word flood is explained by water upon the earth. And are you all familiar with the word gloss and what gloss is? Okay. It's the same word that we get glossary from. Glossa in Greek means simply a language or a tongue. And so what they would do, just like in your, if you have an NIV study Bible and you got all those notes in the margin or at the bottom, that's what they would do. If something was unclear, they would write in the margin an explanation or some sort of definition, and those were called glosses. And I wanted to read a little bit, see if I can find this, about glosses, because it's fascinating. Some of these, it's when you can actually read the original manuscripts, and I thought it was in this book, but I couldn't find it. But I remember reading that the monks who were primarily responsible for copying, especially later on and into the Middle Ages, these guys were just people like us. And they're writing under horrible conditions most of the time. And you find written into the margins, monks complaining about their backs and how sore their backs are because what they've been doing, or that it's so cold that their ink was freezing and they couldn't write. Some of them at the end of a manuscript would write, "Praise be to God," you know, because they actually got through the thing. And it's fascinating to see that all this stuff is taking place. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to find... There were penalties for the monks if they made mistakes. And where was that? Let's see if I can find this. Shoot, I had it marked. I thought I wrote it down too. Where I was going to go with this. Oh, here we go. It's over here. Page 207, if you're in your books. If not, I'll just read it to you. Oh, no, that's about the cost. 210 is about the glosses. These are about the penalties. We talked about when the church was really growing after Diocletian destroyed so many of the books, and Constantine came back and he ordered all these books. So lots of books were being copied quickly. And during this period, the Christian church grew so quickly that the emperor requested Eusebius to have 50 new copies of the scripture copied for the churches of Constantinople. From about the 4th century, it was primarily the work of monks to study and copy the scriptures. About 800, Theodore the Studite, abbot of the Studium at Constantinople, which was well known for copying scriptures, composed the following penalties in order to maintain high standards for copying manuscripts. And here we go. A diet of bread and water was the penalty set for the scribe who became so much interested in the subject matter of what he was copying that he neglected his task of copying. Monks had to keep their parchment leaves neat and clean on penalty of 130 penances. If anyone should take without permission another's quaternion, that is, the ruled and folded sheets of parchment, 50 penances were prescribed. If anyone should make more glue than he could use at one time, and it should harden, then he must do 50 penances. If a scribe broke his pen in a fit of temper, perhaps after having made some accidental blunder near the end of an otherwise perfectly copied sheet, he had to do 30 penances. I just love that. The other thing that I wanted to read you is that we forget how expensive this process was. Little bit here. Some books, such as the Gospels, were originally circulated orally, whereas Paul's letters were recorded at the outset to send to their recipients. So the autographs were either written by their authors or dictated to scribes who transcribed the letters. Paul sometimes requested that his letters be circulated to other churches, like in Colossians 4:16, and thus the autographs must have been copied almost immediately after they were written. It's doubtful that the early church set apart a specific group of professional scribes for this particular purpose. Scribes were more likely hired, or individuals in the church copied the letters. This would explain why there are so many copies of the New Testament books and why there are more mistakes in the New Testament books than there are in the copies of the Old Testament. The speedy multiplication of copies, even by non-professional scribes, sometimes took precedence over strict accuracy or detail. So they needed speed and quantity rather than quality. When prose works were copied, a line called a stichos, having 16 or sometimes 15 syllables, was frequently used as a measure for determining the market price of a manuscript. A price-fixing edict issued in AD 301 by the Emperor Diocletian set the wages of scribes at the rate of 25 denarii for 100 lines in writing of the first quality and 20 denarii for the same number of lines in writing the second quality. Now, Diocletian wasn't talking about Bible passages or books here, because he was burning all of those. But that was the price, the going price in the empire at that time. According to the computation of Rendell Harris, the cost of producing one complete Bible, such as Codex Sinaiticus, would have come to about 30,000 denarii, a sizable sum notwithstanding steadily rising inflation. Now, to help put this into perspective, Bruce Metzger goes on to say that in the preceding century under Caracalla, a legionary, okay, a Roman soldier, was paid a stipend of about 750 denarii per year. So if a soldier is making 750 denarii a year and a complete Bible costs 30,000, you can see, and what he says here, for a church to hire a scribe to copy one of Paul's letters or one of the Gospels would therefore have been very expensive. So these are very expensive processes to do. And with these professional scribes. So you can see, again, to just put a finer point on, if a book was copied a lot, there had to be a reason to do it. If a letter was copied, there had to be a reason to do it, because it's very expensive. All right? So I wanted to just bring those out. But I love those monks. Those guys were great.
Did they have pages or scrolls?
What's that?
Did they have pages or scrolls?
Oh, by the 8th century, we're going to be talking codex. So those have been like bound books,
so
you know.
You'd only mess up one page, right?
Yeah, that's the nice thing about a codex. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Tony?
Was there any evidence that Jesus transcribed anything?
None whatsoever that he wrote anything at all. No.
In the dirt.
In the dirt. But we know that he could read, right? Because he stands up in Nazareth and he reads from the Isaiah scroll. So we know he can read, and presumably he could write too. If he was taught to read, he was taught to write. But we have no evidence that he ever wrote anything down or recorded his message in that way. So, yeah, Peter.
What would the term be for situational analysis? For example, we said Jesus never wrote anything down. Can we show that, Jesus at the well, the woman at the well draws the water. Who's the witness? So can we do that and say that Jesus must have rendered this at least orally? And so he is in some ways. And we have the other thing where it says that many more books could have been written.
Mm-hmm.
But this is given so that you might believe. So there must have been a huge oral tradition, and some of it must have come from Greek.
Oh, absolutely. With just no evidence it came in written form. That's an easy one, though. It gets much more. You heard what he was saying? You know, if Jesus was alone talking to the woman at the well in Samaria, then how was this recorded? Who was the witness? Well, maybe she was. You know, maybe he was. Maybe he told his disciples later. But how about the agony in the garden? I mean, when was that transmitted to anybody? Because he went right to the cross. Did he tell them after the resurrection? Or, you know, but there's lots of instances like that where stories are told that there was no witness, no surviving witness. How did they get those stories? We don't know. Also, there's what's known as agrapha. These are words attributed to Jesus that don't occur in the New Testament, or I'm sorry, in the Gospels. So in the letters of Paul and others, words are attributed to Jesus that we have no record of him saying. So obviously, yes, there's a much larger tradition, orally or possibly written, than what actually ended up in the four Gospels.
Is there a word for this sort of situational analysis as to probability, relationship to probability and situation? Is there a term for that?
Not that I'm aware of. Other than just textual criticism. I mean, that would come under the broad heading of trying to determine the most plausible reading, or did Jesus actually say this? Was this added later? I mean, that's what textual critics do. They're trying to determine, was this an original rendering? Was it a redaction, an emendation? Was it added later? And they're looking at all these witnesses and trying to tell. But stuff like that, I mean, there's just no way to know. You know, you could come up with some plausible scenario of how Jesus encounter with the devil at Gethsemane, how did that get transmitted in such detail down to the actual quotes of what was going on? We don't know. You know, just not a way to know. Yeah.
You know, Jesus fed the masses with the fish and the loaves. Now that, you know, I'm a Presbyterian, so, you know, looks like some of those people, you got the boys fish and everyone came up with the food. I mean, I was probably there. I was sharing that. That's why I've always thought that my little boy giving up his made everyone else get up and give it. And I got really criticized for that. And, you know, it was a literalist. And that's something to know. He actually made and just kept from the dish of bread. And it doesn't make sense. I got really mad at me. But I don't know how other churches look at it. They get up.
In terms of what, the multiplication of loaves and fishes?
Feeding the masses. Took the little boy or his fish and his bread, and everybody had more than enough to eat. Jesus started getting it, and we got through it more than enough to share. The Presbyterian way of things is that everyone who had brought their lunches should have been able to help.
Oh, I see. So taking the miraculous nature out of it?
He actually kept bringing it, just kept more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, once again, are you more conservative or are you more liberal? Are you more strict literalist or you tend to take things metaphorically? See, these are biases that we bring to the text. There's a word for that. It's called eisegesis. Eisegesis is reading into a text. Exegesis is taking out of a text. And so what we think are biases, if we don't believe that the miracles were literally to be taken that way, as a literal miracle, then when we read the text, we're going to see it in the way that you're expressing the Presbyterians did. But if we believe in miracles literally, then we're going to take it in a different way.
Yeah, ours, I guess we weren't popular in Presbyterian, but we weren't quite so.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than one time Presbyterian.
Yeah. And the mainline denominations like Presbyterians and Lutherans and Episcopalians, they tend to be more liberal in their thinking. And so they would be more apt to take things metaphorically or figuratively than literally. Yeah, Jen?
I was just going to ask you, okay, I think in the Bible there's a story about a woman who shares like what tiny bit of food she has left with a stranger, and then it just keeps going and going and going. Now I was kind of curious, do the Presbyterians look at that as...
I can't speak for Presbyterians. Just my daily started.
Did your church interpret that as symbolic?
Well, my minister was a doctor. He had a PhD, and he said, does it really matter? He was a smart man. He turned around. I mean, does it really matter if the people were fed? People came with us, and they came with us, and they get the message, and they were all fed, and they got fed, and that's the answer. So he always turned it
So that though is interpretation of the text. You know, that's not part of the transmission of the text, that's interpretation. You know, we've got the text now. By this time, 2,000 years later, it's pretty set in stone. I mean, yeah, people are still trying to consolidate and come up with better readings, but we're not actively changing the text for any arbitrary reason. And when scholars translate a dynamic or thought for thought, where there's some subjective thought process has to go into it, they tend to do that with boards of scholars, large boards, to even out the possibility of individual error. Does that make sense to you? You know, rather than a paraphrase done by a single person like Eugene, what's his name, Peterson. You know, he can do that because it's a paraphrase. But these dynamic tend to be done by boards of scholars to just average out any possible error and to make it harder to make an error, one person make a real egregious mistake. Yeah.
Okay, so in that example that Calvo gave, you mentioned that we're going to look for that under eisegesis, which is sort of like an inductive inductive reasoning or something. How does that differentiate from this consolidation and the worldview?
Well, there could be some of that going on in the changes that they made, absolutely, because the way that the community or way that the individual copyist feels about something theologically or any other way is going to color the way that they tend to go, either to, as Bill said, actually cheat and just change the text outright, or to shade the meaning based on some possible alternatives that gives right. But yeah, it's the same process. It's just now we don't change the text. We just interpret it. We talk about it differently, but we don't physically change it. In the early days, they would actually physically change the text. You know, remember, there's no printing presses. They got to hand copy this stuff, and so it gave them the opportunity to do that. But yeah, same process, same mindset. All right? If you turn the page, let's take a look at these three different ways over time that scholars have tried to explain what they see as they look at the variations in the Old Testament text. Now, back in the... Yeah. I am on page 169. Okay, you see those little circles and things?
Yeah.
So in the mid-19th century, the 1800s, this scholar named De Lagarde, he came up with the idea, as he's looking at the slight variations that he finds in the Masoretic text, this is the Hebrew Bible, right? He says that since there is commonality between what he sees, they all point to a single mother text, a single archetype, all right, which is the single dot. And from that single text, you know, evolved or descended all of the variations that he sees. Therefore, it's possible to reverse the process, go back in time, and find that archetype, you know, that gave rise to all these. Well, a generation later, Paul Kael, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, he looks at it in a completely different way. And he says that the Masoretic text that we have is the harmonization of different texts. Because now with more witnesses that have come down the pike between these two scholars, he sees that there are significant variations between the texts. And so what he sees now is actually what we have later in time is a harmonization of those, a smoothing out of those differences. So he's looking at it in exactly the opposite way. Now you bring that forward another couple generations, and Albright actually can now see, with more witnesses and more time to look at those witnesses, can see, or he believes he can see, the division between textual families. And he can start to categorize these differences, find the similarities, and group them. And so these are the groupings that he had for local textual families for the Old Testament alone. So the similarities that occurred between the Palestinian text, Samaritan Pentateuch, which is the first five books that was being used by the Samaritans, the Masoretic text of Chronicles, and several of the Qumran texts, he saw a family there that had the same sort of variations. And then the Babylonian text and the Masoretic text was another, and then the Egyptian and the Septuagint were another. So he actually could see families of text that then were standardized in the first century into the Masoretic text. So this is sort of an evolution as you go through time. What's driving the evolution are more and more witnesses, more and more time to catalog and categorize and compare all these witnesses, and you start to see patterns in it. Now, are the patterns real or are they imagined? You know, you look at something long enough and you can see a pattern almost anywhere, it seems like. Yeah, so... But scholars are getting pretty clear, and especially in the New Testament, the families seem to be very clear. So go ahead and turn the page, and let's look at the same sort of graphic for the New Testament. And we've already talked about this, but this at least gives you a little bit more of a graphic rendering of what's going on. We have an autograph. Oh, page 221, right. We have an autograph. As the autograph is being copied and recopied in various geographical areas, the changes start to occur. But they occur localized, and so the same changes are occurring in each one of these areas. So now we have the four main textual families that are recognized by scholars. And really there's only three main ones. The Caesarean text is disputed by some as actually being a text at all. But some scholars see it, so it's represented here. Alexandrian, Caesarean, the Western, which would be the Roman, and the Byzantine. Now, if you turn the page again, I've got a map there. It kind of breaks this out geographically, so you can see where these four textual families were actually coming from geographically. So you see the Western text over there centered around Italy and Rome. The Byzantine text in what is now present-day Turkey. And Byzantium, or Constantinople, the city, is delineated there. The Caesarean text around Caesarea in what is now Syria. And then Alexandria in Egypt. And so we have these four textual families in their respective geographical locations. And the dotted line is the line between East and West. Okay, giving you that political and social demarcation point between the Eastern and Western texts. Let's read a little bit of the textual families column right there. The classification of New Testament text into textual families developed by Westcott and Hort has been expanded by New Testament textual critics. The concept of textual families is very simple. Manuscripts that are copied from one another bear strong similarities to one another. So once a change is made, whether it's one of those unintentional errors, a didography, a haplography, any one of those mistakes, as another copy is made from that copy, it tends to retain the mistake that was made or the change that was made. If it's an intentional mistake, there's even a greater chance that that is going to be carried on because you don't even know that it was a change. Some things are obvious, and some things are corrected by following scribes as they copy. They can see, oh, two words in a row, drop one. But when a mistake is made in a general area and the copies are made, they tend to carry that thing on. All right. Just like making a Xerox copy. If you make the Xerox copy with the same little hairline mark on it, it's going to have that mark in it, and you're going to see that. And anytime you see that mark, you know, if it was a piece of dust or a hair on the glass when that copy was made, you know it came from that machine at that particular location because that's an identifying mark. That's exactly what these textual critics are doing. When they see the same mistake occurring in the same place, and they have an older manuscript, they can put it with that family. And that's how they're seeing all these things going across. Textual families were often restricted to the locality where they were copied unless a manuscript was transported to a different region. Oh, now that brings up a whole other problem. Someone carries his manuscript from Byzantium to Alexandria and leaves it there, and now it's copied there. Well, now we have, so it's not as cut and dried as you would think it would be, right? Families are thus named for the area where they developed and can be located on map 3. Scholars have categorized many manuscripts into related families and have evaluated them to determine which are more accurate. Once an error has been made, you can turn the page, it generally remains within that family unless it is removed for some reason. Scholars rate the accuracy of the various textual families in order from most to least accurate. And look at this order that he gives here. That the Alexandrian family is the most accurate, then the Caesarean family, then the Western family, and finally the Byzantine family. Which family gave rise to the King James Version? The Byzantine family. KJV only folks aren't going to like that much. And why did they come up with this order? It's because of those five reasons. That older is better. That shorter is better. Remember those reasons we came? The Alexandrian family is the oldest and the shortest and fits all of those rules. But those rules, remember, were made to be broken where context and that's where the art process comes into it. It's not always the case, but generally speaking, that's the reason that modern scholars tend to put the Alexandrian family, this family that was only discovered in the last 150 years, because these were texts that were hidden away. One King James only person disparagingly puts it that, for instance, Sinaiticus was found in the trash room of St. Catherine's Monastery on the Sinai Peninsula, as if to say they knew it was so bad that it was getting ready to be burned. But the point is that it was found in a pristine state, and it's older by far than a lot of the other manuscripts that we had at the time before it was discovered. Same thing with Vaticanus and Alexandrinus and so on and so forth, all from that same family. All right. When manuscripts contain characteristics from more than one family, they are sometimes referred to as a mixed manuscript. Sometimes errors in certain manuscripts may be corrected by comparing that manuscript with other manuscripts outside its text family, but it's more likely that new errors will continue to be incorporated into later manuscripts in each successive copy. If you turn the page back, at the bottom there, there's a little graphic between the single text and the eclectic text. Okay, these are two schools of thought on how to get the most plausible reading and how to get back to that original text. In the single text idea, you use the readings from a single text or a single textual family. This is the method that was used to come up with the King James Version. The majority text at the time was all that they had, which was all from the Byzantine family. All right? Greek text, absolutely. Why was it the majority text? Because the Byzantine Empire fell in 1453 to the Ottoman Turks. And with it, the exodus from Byzantium, the exodus from that area of all of those Greek scholars, all of those people, bringing with them their Bibles, bringing with them their ideas and their knowledge. It's no coincidence that the Byzantine Empire fell in 1453 and the Renaissance began shortly thereafter. Because what was Western Europe plunged into at the fall of Rome in 476 but the Dark Ages that lasted for 1,000 years? What triggered the Renaissance? What triggered the flowering of new art and science? Well, the fall of the Byzantine Empire forced all these scholars out as they were fleeing from the Turks into Western Europe, carrying all this knowledge with them. And there's a lot of reasons why the Renaissance started, but that's a major one. But what it did was it suddenly flooded Western Europe with these Greek texts, because before what was in use was the Latin version, the Vulgate, the Western version. Suddenly you had all of these Greek versions that came over. And since they were the majority of all the text, that was seen as the primary one because it was the most prevalent. In 1611, when the King James Version was translated, that's what they had to work with, was this majority text, and that's what the scholars used to translate from. Yeah.
David, can you clarify at least your opinion of how these changes, and especially the Greek text, the Byzantine text that influenced King James Version, what the relationship of these changes that we're talking about, and the consolidation of theology? Okay. Going to that period, we know a little bit about what theology was like in Greek Orthodox tradition or Byzantine tradition. We have some idea of the Alexandrian, we have some idea, obviously a lot of ideas about the Western Roman. So, how in your view does the theology, in your mind, are we saying that the theology of these different theologies varying slightly, like the cloud of unknowing and all that sort of thing, are based upon errors? Or is it consolidation that has brought this about and not so much errors? I mean, can we make a conclusion there?
Well,
this is the growth of the...
The differences in these textual families are the result of everything we've been talking about. Some of them are simple copy mistakes, You know, and some of them are actual emendations. They're critical changes to the text based on these various understandings. Remember, they're shades of meaning. They're not huge, huge differences, but there are omissions, there are additions, and there are copy mistakes. The key is that scholars can see where these came from as they trace everything backward. You know, when you look at this tree here, if you have this copy here and you start following all these trains back, you're getting closer and closer to whatever that archetype was. What was this first copy in Byzantium that was the archetype that all these copies were made from? And then if you notice these dotted lines between the families, these are where critics have found similarities between the textual families. So they can see where maybe a manuscript was transported from one area to another, and it retains now portions from both of these textual families. Those are those mixed manuscripts we talk about. So that's what we're doing, is moving this back. It's not to say that huge theological or dogmatic beliefs of the church came from these errors. Most likely what they did was maybe put some of them in, because they were coloring the meaning based on what they already believed. Yeah. But what the cure for this is to the modern mind is now the eclectic text. And if you look at the eclectic text, it collects the best readings from many manuscripts. So instead of just using one or one textual family, the King James Bible was based on maybe 12 or 13 manuscripts that were available to the scholars at that time. You know, a text like the NIV or the NASB has tens of thousands. And so the difference is, take as many as you can and then harmonize them to get to the most plausible reading. All right? And let me give you some examples I think are coming up here. You can read on we were on page 223. There's that column about the eclectic text versus the single text. You can read that one on your own. And then also on page 223, under evaluating the evidence, there's that quote that I told you about. Scribes who thought were more dangerous than those who wished merely to be faithful in copying what was before them. That's kind of cool. And then go to page 224. Our last two pages, it looks like we might even finish tonight. The last page will give you some examples, Peter. But doing this in order, in page 224, again, determining the most plausible reading, it's the same rules that we were looking at before. Manuscript must be weighed, not counted. Determine the reading that would most likely give rise to the other. The more distinctive is usually preferable. The shorter is usually preferable. Determine which reading is more appropriate in its context. And now there's a sixth one. Examine parallel passages for any differences and determining why they may appear, which is based on everything that we've been talking about. All right? But now look at these. What are the witnesses that we're actually dealing with in the New Testament to try to make these comparisons and these determinations? Well, you got the New Testament manuscripts themselves, of course. Papyri manuscripts, early codices, that would be the early books as opposed to the scrolls. Minuscule manuscripts, that has to do with the type of lettering that they used. Okay, they were smaller. And so we know historically when Greek was used in all of capital letters called unciles. We know when they used minuscules and started to use a smaller type. So we can date manuscripts based on the type of lettering that they used in the calligraphy. Because remember, very rarely did anyone put a date on a manuscript. It's very rare. It happens every once in a while, and then the clouds part and the sun shines through for the scholars when that happens. But it's not very often. Usually they're using these types of clues to tell what region or what era that they came from. All right? And then Byzantine lectionaries. Lectionaries are actually books that were used in the church services, you know, for the actual conduction of services, where they would then quote the scriptures again. That's another way for us to be able to have something to compare with. Then versions of the Bible, of the New Testament, Old Latin, Latin Vulgate, the Old Syriac, Peshitta, Coptic, Gothic, Armenian, Ethiopic, and all of those. And then Church Fathers. Remember we said that in the writings of the Church Fathers, you could recreate 90% of the New Testament from the quotes that they put into their writings as they were, you know, talking about them and commenting on them or refuting heresies or whatever they were doing. So if you gather all this stuff from, you know, all these different church fathers, you can recreate most of the New Testament. All of that stuff together is this cloud of witnesses that these scholars are using, again, to try to get back to the original text. And let's go to the last page and look at some of these intentional changes in the New Testament. And some of these are kind of interesting. And then we'll call it an evening. But changes in grammar or spelling. Okay, that's an easy one. If you found that you found an error in spelling or grammar, that would be likely changed by a copyist. And you see an example there in Matthew 1:7-8. Harmonization. Okay, that one is a little bit further afield and more subjective. Modifying a passage to agree with another passage. In Luke 23:38, words similar to John 19:20, it was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek, were added by later copyists. Okay? So they're trying to harmonize it with other passages that they know about at the time. Adding natural complements or words that go together. All right, Matthew 6:4, in the open, openly, was added to your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. In Matthew 27:4, and Pharisees was added to scribes. And so we see those additions being made to try to complement what the scholar believes was a fuller understanding of that particular term. So we can see when those things were added. Older manuscripts don't have them. Other manuscripts do. Remember, if shorter is better, generally speaking, when we find a new Bible that's older and it's shorter and it doesn't contain these phrases, then the later versions are going to leave them out. Or if they do put them in, they put them in brackets. And then there'll be a footnote down there saying that the oldest and most reliable manuscripts don't contain these. Your NIV Study Bible is great for that. They notate all of that stuff, and you'll find those things in brackets. All right, clearing up difficulties. Matthew 1:2-3, the composite quote from Malachi 3:1 and Isaiah 40:43, attributed to Isaiah the prophet, was changed to in the prophets. Okay, conflated readings, combining two or more readings. All right, Luke 24:53. Some manuscripts read blessing, others read praising. Some old Latin manuscripts, and still others read praising and blessing. So, you know, again, little changes here and there. Now, here's where we get into more of what Peter's talking about, theological changes. In Luke 2:41, was changed to Joseph and Mary from the old Latin, which was Joseph and his mother, possibly to safeguard the doctrine of the virgin birth by clarifying that Joseph was not Jesus' biological father. Okay? So you can see why that change was made. Kind of like the one that we talked about last week, where there was that Trinitarian formula, where the original rendering was, what was it, the Father, there are three that testify. I can't remember. It was the Spirit, the Blood, and the Water or something, and that was changed to Father, Son, and Spirit. And so the Latin version was directly trying to make a Trinitarian formula that doesn't exist in the older manuscripts. That would be an example of a theological change, or change for a theological reason. And then finally, just other additions. In Luke 24:53, Amen was added at the end of the verse. Okay, so there's lots of reasons for these changes to be made, from simple copying errors to a theological change on purpose. But what we find is that as they look across all of these witnesses and you see these textual families, why do they do all this work? Why does it matter? Because what they're trying to do is get to the most plausible reading of each verse so that they can compile a version of the Bible that they believe is the closest as possible to the original text, which mirrors the autograph. And that's what this is all about. That's what textual criticism is all about, trying to get as close as possible to the autograph that no longer exists. Yeah?
Steve, I have a prayer request from a little child that I found on the floor at Cornerstone, and it's from the Iglesia de Cristo. Mm-hmm. And it's in really poor English. It took me about 10 minutes to read this and go, what the heck? But I bet that each person here, as they read this, will finally get what it says, with a very similar conclusion, but the spelling. So each thing, and I was thinking about this today, so if I could just read this.
Sure.
I'll read it as I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Help me with, make Ashley to be his God. Help me with, help me to see to get my mom and dad back together. And the next one here is something Gutierrez, lie that would God love him. But if you read it as it's spelled, it's nothing like that, because the grammatical errors are so bad, and having him, Ashley obviously is a her, so it's written as him, because the interpretation is kind of lost there from Spanish to English.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought this was a great illustration of what you're saying here as it went down the list, and somebody else could get a hold of it and go, well, wait, let me correct the spelling a little bit, or him really was her, so I'm going to write this as it should be. And really,
absolutely. That's a perfect example of what goes on. Because remember, these copyists are reading manuscripts that vary in grammatical consistency or the level of which the original writer was able to accomplish. And so, for instance, along the lines of what you're saying, sometimes I get emails that really strike me, and then I want to include them in our newsletter or in something else. Well, what I typically do is I fix the spelling errors, and I clean up the grammar, especially if I'm going to attribute it to that person. I want them to be shown in pristine grammatical state, you know. And so I clean it up before I represent it. It's the same idea that these scribes are going through. There's nothing nefarious about it. You know, they're not trying to subvert Western, you know, religion or civilization. You know, especially if you really revere this text and you find a spelling error, you're going to fix it, you know. There's nothing that doesn't change anything. Like you said, even reading that, you can still read through to the intent. You know, when you find these copyist errors, you can still read through to the intent. But what they're trying to do is to clean it up. And what now textual critics are doing in a backwards way is they're using those clues to find which textual families these various manuscripts belong to, so they can again try to harmonize everything and get to the most plausible reading. But that's a great example of exactly what's going on here. And it's always best to try to put it back into our own terms. You know, these monks and these copyists, they were still human beings trying to write with frozen fingers in an unheated monastery someplace, you know, all hours, you know, doing this all day long with their backs aching. When they got to the end of it and they didn't blow it, they didn't make a mistake, and they didn't have to do 150 penances because they broke their quill, you know, and it's praise God down at the bottom of this thing, you know. It's so wonderful to see that it's human beings who are transmitting God's word, you know, using the processes that were available to them at the time. You know, it's a very beautiful human process that God is directing in some way that maybe we don't understand. But because we're approaching this as people of faith, we do believe that God was involved in the process. But we need to take into account all of this. And again, you know, the question becomes, how do we take this information now and synthesize it into what we believe about Scripture and God's revelation to us, direct revelation to us? Does it diminish the importance of his revelation because we see the human element? Or does it, in a very ironic way, enhance it? You know, for me, it's enhancing it.
And I think the thread is God's character throughout the whole thing, you know, because that's the stability of all human race, is the character of God and who he is. And the grammatical changes and things like that doesn't change the core of that. That's what we build our house on. And reading from the Message, from the NIV, from the King James, and all those things, it's very wonderful to be able to do, and to have the Spirit just kind of give you a piece of that. Okay, I can understand a little bit better if I read it out of that, or a text that I can. And again, I think the other thing is that you brought up the culture. It's so important, because whatever they were going through at that time, they're like, it's like when I go to church, and if I'm going through something and you read the Scripture, or I'm studying something, I'm going to grab whatever I need out of that at that moment to feed me. Whereas someone else will read it and think, oh, that is just such a blessing, and I'm thinking, this is such a struggle. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, that's probably where some of those texts that you were just looking at, all those different, you know, it depends on what they were culturally going through at the time.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And times of crisis do bring out, you know, the intensity and the urgency of it. And so if a local community was really going through a persecution or something difficult, then they're going to be reading that Scripture in a different way, and that's going to color each successive copy, little bit by little bit, you know. and the rapidity with which these copies had to be made. You know, the less than professional copyists that were employed to make all these copies happen. So you see a lot more mistakes in New Testament manuscripts than you do in Old Testament manuscripts because of that reason, you know. And so we need to harmonize all that. We need to deal with all that as well, you know. Wow, we actually got through all that stuff. Can you believe it? Not bad. Did I burn out anyone's brain cells on this one? I know this is a lot of stuff. Great, because I really wanted you all to get a little more meat on the bones, because I know where we left it conceptually last week, it probably hadn't quite sunk in, but I hope this gives you a really good idea of what's going on. Next week is really cool. Next week is one of my most favorite sections. We're going to talk about the actual development of writing from pictograms to alphabet, and it's a fascinating story, and I'll have pictures for you that you can hold and see how the alphabet and how the writing system move forward. And then, of course, the part that played in the transmission of the Bible as well. And from there, we're going to go into some readings of the extra-canonical books. I know y'all been waiting for that one. Got to hear those infancy gospels. And then we'll get into versions. And so we'll talk a lot more about what Marian was talking about. What are the different English versions? And what's the differences between them? How do you know which versions are dynamic and which are literal and which are this and which are that? So you can make selections as you're reading the Bible as well. So that's all coming to a theater near you. Yeah. So.